Okay, let's go ahead and open up to Matthew chapter 13. This is kind of the grand finale here. We're going to finish up the parables no matter what. I'm going to finish up these parables tonight because they form a beautiful little package. So I think the best way to start is, let's take a look at where we've come so far. I'm not going to go into all the details. We've covered these first five parables already in detail over the previous weeks, but I just want to bring to mind the structure that I think these parables fit into. It's a little different than probably the way you've heard the parables presented before, and so I'm going to hopefully give you enough background information, some of the basic reasons why I'm grouping them this way. So we saw, first of all, that this is going to be a time of instruction and understanding. We're pulling out the idea that Peter talked about in 1 Peter, where he's talked about how the prophets wished they knew the manner of time. What kind of time? What's going to characterize this time? When they looked at the prophecies, many of them just look like, oh, there's going to be the preaching, and then there's going to be God returning in his wrath and judgment, and then the establishment of the kingdom. Boom, boom, boom. Three phrases in one sentence, and it looks like it happened all together, but other passages look like they don't happen together, and they didn't have information on this time period between the first and second coming of Christ. That's what these parables are revealing, is what that time period is going to look like. The prophets expected when God began fulfilling his promises to Israel that the knowledge of God would cover the earth as the waters cover the sea. But these parables reveal that that's not going to be the case for the time between the first coming and the second coming of Christ. During this time, it's going to be a time of not clarity. It's going to be a time that requires instruction, that leads to understanding. And remember in the sower parable, he gave the parable of the sower, and then he interrupted it with information on why he's using the parables. And he's using the parables as a means of instructing his disciples and bringing them to understanding. How does the parable of the sower open? It opens with those with the unprepared ground had no understanding. That's the first thing you read in that parable. But how does it end? It ends with those who bearing fruit have understanding. And so we've put that together, and we've covered that in depth previously, but that's the first category here. That's what's going to characterize this time. It's not going to be a time of permanence and finality. It's going to be a time of change, instruction that leads to understanding. Those with unprepared ground can have their ground prepared through the preaching of the word of the kingdom. Those who are unbelievers can become believers. Those who are believers but not bearing fruit can become believers that bear fruit. And those believers that are bearing fruit can bear more fruit. But of course, the flip side is true as well, right? And we read a lot about this in James. The flip side is they could start out good and then slip back, especially as that persecution intensifies during that tribulation period. So this ministry would also include edification and encouragement and reproof and correction to keep people heading the right way, keep them focused on Christ. So that first parable, especially with regard to the time of instruction and understanding, and remember these because these are all going to be paired up, as you see already here, between the fourth and fifth ones, they're going to be paired up with another parable in Matthew 13. So that's the first one. Then that kind of tells us how this time period is going to begin. It's going to be initiated when the believing remnant's going to start just sowing the word of the kingdom with wild abandon. Kind of like what Jesus and John were doing in the first 12 chapters of Matthew. Jesus is going to stop doing that now, but it's going to pick up again. We have another foretaste of it in the preaching of Peter at Pentecost. And then it's going to reach its fulfillment out in that tribulation period. That's going to start, and they're just going to start sowing the word of the kingdom. Throw it up on the streets, throw it up on the rocky ground, throw it in the weeds, throw it. They're going to send it everywhere because this is a time of change. As I mentioned earlier, the unbeliever can become a believer. The believer can bear more fruit. And bear fruit and even more fruit. And so now when we get to this, that leads into the wheat and the tares, because now he gives us the end of this period. The period is going to end at Christ's return with his angels. And at that point, and during, in between the beginning and the end, the children of the kingdom, which are the result of the word of the kingdom from the first parable, produce the children of the kingdom. God's going to plant them in the earth. But during this time, the children of the evil one, the children of Satan, are going to be planted amongst them, the wheat and the tares. And they're not going to be separated during this time. This wasn't going to be a time of revelation and judgment. That's why I've labeled this parable under that heading. It's going to be a time of covering and hiddenness. And I think the key verse, I've referred back to this many times, but I think since it's such a key verse, we should go back to chapter 10. Matthew 10, just flip back a couple pages, and we'll see here, he's just sending out the 12 to carry out the ministry without him being present. And this is one of the key verses, I believe, for these parables. Verse 26, Matthew 10, verse 26, he says, "Fear them not, therefore, for there is nothing covered." See, this is going to be a time when things are going to be covered. When that it shall not be revealed, but it's going to be revealed. And then look at the final phrase here, and of course this phrase really comes into our fourth and fifth parables here. There's going to be a time when things are hidden, but in the end, what the parable of the wheat and the tares talks about at the end, at Christ's return and his angels, it's going to be revealed. It's going to be uncovered. The wicked is going to be separated from the just. The righteous is going to be, righteous person is going to be separated from the unrighteous person. The children of Satan are going to be separated from the children of God. And that's how that's all going to end. But in between that time, good and evil are going to coexist. And during the sowing of the word of the kingdom. And that leads into our third parable then. That leads right into the mustard seed. So now he's given us how this is all going to restart, the sowing of the word of the kingdom with wild abandon, and how it's going to end when Christ returns with his angels. And now what happens in between? What happens in between is God takes this insignificant thing, the start to this program, just at this, when we get past the resurrection, when Peter starts preaching at Pentecost, all there is they're preaching a king who'd been crucified. You know, in the world standards, that sounds pretty insignificant. You can't get pretty much less significant than that. By the world's standards, of course, not by God's standards. And there's Peter and the 12 and 120 people with him at Pentecost. And it starts out pretty small, pretty insignificant by the world standards. And we brought out then this whole thing that I think is so important to get now if we're going to put these parables together, the whole Exodus motif. When was another time in Israel's history that God took Israel as an insignificant thing and turned her into something great? That's that Exodus back in their ancient history. Remember how many people went into the Exodus? 70 children of Jacob went in to Egypt. And what did they come out with? They came out with millions. They grew into a great people, a great nation, and if they had answered the test right at Sinai, they would have been taken into that great kingdom. But he put them in there, 70 Israelites come into Egypt, and he hides them there. And right under the noses of the Egyptians, right under the nose of Satan's policy of evil, right under the Egyptians' noses, they grow into a great people that's going to lead to a great kingdom, the tree representing that kingdom. And just think of, we read the beginning of Exodus, and what to say, a new Pharaoh came on the scene. And he's like, looks and says, wow, where did these people come from? They're greater than us. And he starts persecuting. The persecution intensifies. That's what's going to happen. That's what's going to characterize out there. In that time, especially in that tribulation period, and especially the last 3.5 years, it's going to be just like it was at the first Exodus, only there's going to be another Exodus where God's going to plant them out. That was parable 2. He plants them in the earth, and right under the noses of Satan, right under the nose of the Gentile nations, right under the nose of the vain religious system, they're going to grow into a great people, a great nation of people, a great kingdom, the kingdom people, the children of the kingdom. And that brings us into this gradual greatness. Now, as we go to the next parable, it was the parable of the leaven. Now, most people automatically associate the leaven parable with the mustard seed parable. But you see, in order to do that, you have to go outside what Jesus says in this parable. Jesus in this parable, when he's talking about the mustard seed, he draws attention to its smallness. He says it's a grain. It's a speck of dust of a mustard seed. And then he goes on and reiterates that it's the least of all seeds. He draws your attention to its leastness. In the leaven parable, he doesn't say anything about smallness or leastness. So you have to read that into that psalm. You have to bring your understanding of bread making into that psalm. But even Jesus, we read last week, a couple of chapters after this, he scolds the 12 for thinking of bread. He's like, this doesn't have anything to do with bread. Get bread out of your head. See, this parable, you could never make bread according to this parable. First of all, she's not, you can't hide yeast or leaven in the middle of dry wheat seed and ever expect to get a loaf of bread. There's no loaf in this parable. There's no kneading in this parable. There's no water in this parable. That's not what he's drawn. It's not about bread. We bring in what Paul wrote. He said, a little leaven leaveneth the whole loaf. But you see, here Jesus doesn't talk about the littleness. So you have to read that into this parable. What is Jesus draws our attention to in the leaven parable isn't the littleness of leaven that grows into something big. It's the hiddenness of the leaven. And we saw that here. It's hidden. The leaven is hidden in the wheat. It's not even hidden in the lump of dough. It's hidden in the wheat seed. And that is what's going to be characterized this time. We talked about the prophetic woman of prophecy, wickedness, and she dispenses this, and she's going to hide this among the wheat seed. And what's the wheat seed? It's the word of the kingdom and the children of the kingdom. And she's going to hide that, and that's going to be allowed to go on until it affects everybody in that believing remnant, all of God's people, all the children of the kingdom. That's going to be a characteristic. And of course, we see some of this already going on in the book of James. So that's actually not to be tied, in my opinion, not to be tied with the mustard seed. It's not the sister parable of the mustard seed. It's because it's stressing the hiddenness. Now let's see what I believe is the sister parable to the leaven. And that's where we left off last time. And that's the treasure. Look at verse 44. Matthew 13, verse 44. Matthew 13, verse 44. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure. Now, what's he drawing our attention? A treasure, not just any treasure. It's a treasure hidden in a field. And if we bring from the second parable where he identified the field as the earth, then we could maybe take that a step further and say this is a treasure hidden in the earth. The leaven is the wicked woman of prophecy hiding the false teachings, the leaven of false teaching in amongst the children of the kingdom. And here the flip side of that is God is going to take these people and hide them in the earth, just like he did in Egypt. He hid them there. And right under the noses of Satan and this woman and the vain religious system, they're going to grow into a great people because he's going to hide them in the earth where they're going to be. He's going to protect them and preserve them through this time. That's the answer to this. Hiding the treasure in the earth is God's answer to the wicked woman hiding her leaven among his people. And he's going to protect her. All right, so that's why we bring in this Exodus motif, if we see just in these parables. And I'm going to go into a little more detail on the Exodus motif because I think I've had more response and interest in that topic after last Sunday than anything else I've taught, which I'm not totally pleased about because I'd rather people got in touch with me about truths from Romans. But we'll go with this. And I thought I'd just take a minute to take a sidestep here and look at this Exodus motif and why I believe, anyway, this is the case with these. First of all, we see this, we've already talked about the gradual greatness, and we saw that was what happened at the Exodus account. If you look up leaven, he then ties it into the leaven motif, and just open up any concordance, and you'll see that all the bulk of references to leaven are in the Exodus account. Passover lamb, the sacrificial system, all that, leaven everywhere. He brings in the leaven motif in this parable, and then he brings in the treasure. Where does God, specifically call Israel his treasure? He's going to make him into his own treasure. That's the Exodus account, Exodus 19:5. So I think there's enough support right here within the parables themselves. But I thought since there was so much interest, I'd take it a step further, just quickly go through some other things. We're not going to turn to all these passages. You can look these up on your own. But I just wanted to bring out a few other things beyond what's in these parables and what comes immediately after these parables. And I think the Exodus motif is carried on through chapter 13 and into chapter 14. First of all, once we're done with the parables here, from verses 53 to 58 in Matthew, Jesus is going to be rejected by his own country. And where is he? Where is his own country? Where did he grow up? Nazareth. And the question is, why did they grow up in, why did he and his family go to Nazareth? Remember the story? Remember how Matthew opens those first 2 and 3 chapters of Matthew? Remember how it all opens? There is a guy named Herod, and he starts persecuting, looking for the king. And what do? They flee to Egypt. The Exodus. They flee to Egypt. And then what do? Then God, Matthew makes a big point out of this in early in Matthew. And he says, and then God called them out of Egypt. He's going to deliver them. He's going to bring them out of Egypt. And they come back into the land of Israel. But they couldn't go back to the Bethlehem area. Where'd they have to go? Because of the persecution there from one of Herod's children. And instead, they went to Nazareth. The whole reason they're in Nazareth is because they went to Egypt, and when they came out of Egypt, they went to Nazareth. So I'd suggest there's from the very beginning of Matthew and how this chapter is going to end, there's an Exodus motif still going on there. Then when we open up into Matthew 14, in verses 1 to 14, guess who's going to come on the scene? Herod. Now, this is the son of the Herod from back then, from Jesus' birth, the incidents at Jesus' birth. But he's now continuing the persecution and is going to shortly kill John the Baptist. And we'll look at that in more detail. But that brings that whole family of Herod back in the picture. And the one thing we're introduced to in Matthew is that Herod, his father, who was the cause of them going into Egypt and coming out again. What's the next thing in Matthew 14, in verses 15 to 21? What's the next thing Jesus does? He goes and he feeds the 5,000. And I don't think I've ever read a commentary that didn't associate that with the manna of God feeding them at the Exodus. Then what's the next thing Jesus does? Jesus goes and he controls the waters and the sea. He walks on the water. And what was the pivotal event in the Exodus? There he controlled the seas and the water so that they could walk through dry shod. So I'd suggest these things all come together I'm not just pulling this Exodus motif out of thin air. I think this is the main driving force, the main thing that's going on, and we see that continued into the 14th chapter of Matthew, the very next chapter. If we want to throw in one other reference, you could go to Luke 10, and here I find this to be one of the most interesting ones. In Luke 8, Jesus gives the parable of the sower. He gives some of these parables. And then in Luke 10, shortly thereafter, what does Jesus do? He sends out the 70. Now, why 70? Why not 60? Why not 80? Well, how many Israelites went into Egypt at the Exodus? 70 Israelites. And they came out a great nation. So I'd just say there's some additional information on the whole Exodus motif. I think it carries over through chapter 13 and on into chapter 14. The main thrust of these parables is revealing the fact that there's going to be another Exodus. And that Exodus is going to happen for this believing remnant, and now it's going to be the one in that tribulation period. God's going to plant them just like he planted the Israelites in Egypt. And right under the noses of the Egyptians, they grew into a great people that the Pharaoh thought was bigger and mightier than the Egyptians. So too, now in these parables, they're learning about how God's going to plant them in the earth. The world's going to think they're insignificant, they're least of all people, they're nothing, and he's going to turn them, just like he did in Egypt, he's going to now plant them in the earth in a larger Exodus, and he's going to plant them, and they're going to grow into a great nation, a great people, and become that great kingdom. What Israelites didn't accomplish in the first Exodus, they're going to accomplish in this Exodus. Took the first exit, broke down the first Exodus, was at Sinai when they went under that law. God gave them a test. They said, have you learned what I've tried to teach you going from Goshen to Sinai? That you don't go under a law, you're not going to be able to do it. If you're going to be my people, I have to do it for you. They get to Sinai and they say, no, we will do it ourselves. And they spent the next 1,500 years under the curses of the law, for the most part, under the curses of the law. And that's what they're still under when they go through this tribulation period. That's the final installment of the fifth course of punishment for that being under that law. Then they're going to deliver them. But you know what they're going to answer? This believing remnant's going to answer at Christ's return? They're going to give the answer the other group of Israelites at the first Exodus should have given. There, when Christ returns, they're going to look on the one they pierced, and they're going to plead with him to treat them graciously. That's the answer the Israelites should have given back at Sinai. It's going to be given here at Christ's return, and he's going to usher them, he's going to deliver them out of Satan's world system. We continue our Egypt motif, the Egypt of the earth, the Egypt of the world, Satan's world system on earth. He's going to deliver them out of that, just like he delivered them out of Egypt. And when he delivers them out of that, just like delivering the Israelites in the first Exodus, it caused the whole Egyptian kingdom to tumble. He destroyed it. So too, when he comes to deliver this believing remnant in this greater Exodus, it's going to be a part of the cause, at least, of the tumbling, of the fall of Satan's kingdom on earth. And he's going to usher them into that kingdom, and God's going to replace Satan's world system on earth with, God's going to replace that with his own world system on earth that we call that kingdom. All right. So there's some more information. It seemed to generate a lot of information on this Exodus motif with the parable. Let's go on and pick it up from here now. All right, so we got the next parable here. We've already talked about the treasure parable. And again, that ties in to the Exodus account. And let's look back at our chart here. That ties in the Exodus account. It brings out the hiddenness concept. During this time, the kingdom will be characterized by Christ finding and hiding the children of the kingdom in the world. And we looked last time where Exodus 19:5, he talks about being the treasure. All right, so now we're back to here. We see these two go together. Contrary to what most people say, most people tie the leaven and the mustard seed together. We're going to keep the mustard seed aside for now. We're tying together the leaven parable because of the hidden concept, and the treasure parable because of the hidden concept. So what goes with the mustard seed? That, I would suggest, is the parable of the great pearl. We're going to see the greatness concept come to the surface again. Look at now verse 45. Matthew 13:45, and let's go on to our next parable. We didn't cover this last time. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man, and seeking goodly pearls. So here we have a merchant man seeking goodly pearls. Notice there's a time element here. When you're seeking something, it's not done in an instant, right? It's an ongoing thing. Just like the mustard seed, it's going to grow. If you've got something growing, it's not going to be done in an instant. It's going to grow. It's a gradual growth to greatness. And here, let's see, finish the parable, and then we'll see what this is, what the merchant is seeking. So he's seeking goodly pearls, who, when he hath found one pearl of what? Greatness. One great pearl. One pearl of great price. Went and sold all that he had and bought it. All right, so I suggest that what goes with the mustard seed is the pearl parable. Its emphasis there is on the gradual greatness, the seeking of the one great pearl. And pearls play a big role in Israel's history. And we'll look at one place, and then we'll go to Revelation and see something about pearls there. Let's just look at the first instance, or one of the main instances here. Go to Malachi. That's the book of the Bible just before Matthew. So you can flip back to the beginning of Matthew, then go back a few more pages. You'll be there. Malachi 3, and we're going to start reading at verse 16. Malachi 3, verse 16. Just to give a little background here, Malachi is bemoaning the fact that the nation has been in the grip of the vain religious system. The vain religious system is persecuting the people of God. You know, it's like what's going to go on in miniature, what's going to go out in big screen out in that tribulation period. They're suffering under the hand of the vain religious system. Now, it's important to realize here we're in Malachi, and then after this, God's going to go silent for 400 years. And guess when he breaks the silence? With the arrival of John the Baptist. And he comes crying in the wilderness. He breaks the silence of God. So there's 400 years between what we read here and our account in Matthew. And that same vain religious system that was persecuting the believing remnant here in Malachi is going to be, is the same vain religious system that's persecuting the people of God in Matthew, only even worse. And then these are the same vain religious system that's going to persecute the believing remnant when God restarts his program with Israel out in that tribulation. And they just keep getting worse and worse. And so now with that little bit of background, let's read though. The bulk of the nation is apostate. It's been taken over by a vain religious system that has nothing anymore to do with God. But look what's always there, verse 16. Then they, Malachi 3:16, then they that feared the Lord spoke often one to another, and the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance. So here you have, in the midst of persecution, under the vain religious system, you have a group of believers. We could call it a believing remnant who remembered God, who feared God, who got together amongst themselves and talked about God and looked for God and prayed to God and all that. And it looked to, they could think that God's not paying any attention to them. They could look like God's going to go silent for 400 years after this. Is God not noticing them? Is God not paying attention to them? Is God not know they're there? Did God forget about them? Look what the Lord says. And the Lord hearkened and heard it, and a book of remembrance was written before him for them. He hears it, but he's not going to do anything about it right then. Instead, he's going to remember them. He gets a book and he writes their names in it. See, that's what these this time between the first and second coming of Christ, it's going to be a time when it's going to look like he's forgotten. Maybe, in light of our parable of the treasure and the pearl, maybe we could even say it's going to look like a time when he's sold all of his things and it doesn't care about his things anymore. But it says he remembered them. He hearkened. He heard them. Now, earlier, going all the way back to Isaiah, you know what God said? He said, I'm not going to listen to you anymore. I'm not going to hear you. When you pray, I'm not going to hear you. That was what he told the vain religious system. But here he's the believing remnant now. Many years after Isaiah wrote, he's still hearing them. He hearkens. He hears them. He writes their name in a book. He hasn't forgotten them. He's not deserting them. And they thought upon his name. Now, verse 17 brings up these jewels concept. It doesn't specifically mention pearls here, so we're not going to drive the comparison too tightly, but I think a pearl would be considered a jewel. So let's just see how he treats his jewels here. Verse 17, and they shall be mine, saith the Lord of hosts. Of course, that goes back to the Exodus 2 right there. And that day when I make up my jewels, and I will spare them as a man spareth his own son. This believing remnant is going to make up his jewels, his pearls, we could say. And look how it closes, because now he's going to bring in our other parables. Verse 18, then shall you return. That's when Christ returns, and he's going to usher them into that kingdom, and they're going to be brought back into the land of the kingdom. And he says here, then shall you return, and then you'll be discerned between the righteous and the wicked. The parable of the tares and the wheat, right? He's going to separate the tares from the wheat. So here, and between them that serve God and him that do not serve God. All right, but let's now go to a specific reference to these pearls. So we see that this believing remnant, he considers his pearl, his treasures, his, what do you call it there, his jewels. Go to Revelation now. Go to Revelation 21, and we'll just look at this real quickly, and then we can finish things up pretty quick after this. Go to Revelation 21. Here we have the climax. Everything's coming to a head here, and he's talking about the New Jerusalem. Let's just pick it up at verse 10. Revelation 21, verse 10. And he carried me away, and in the spirit, to a great and high mountain, and showed me the great city, the holy Jerusalem, descending out of heaven. The heaven from God. So here you have the New Jerusalem. It's going to descend out of heaven and it's going to come to the earth. Having the glory of God, verse 11. And the light was like unto a stone, most precious, even like jasper, stone, crystal. He goes through all this description of how the marvelousness of this. We're not going to read down through the whole passage, but looked at Oh, let's just pick it up at verse 17. And he measured the wall, and he gives the parameters of that. And the building of the wall was of jasper, and the city was pure gold, like clear glass. And the foundations of the wall of the city were garnished with all manner of precious stones. The first foundation, jasper, and sapphire, emerald, sardius, beryl, topaz, go all the way through here, amethyst. And then the verse we want is verse 21 here in this description of this New Jerusalem. And the 12 gates were 12 pearls. Each gate was one great pearl. A great pearl. And the 12 gates. Now, what are these 12 gates? If we read a little more in this chapter, let's go up to verse 14. We probably should have read this. Go to verse 14. I just scan up a few verses to verse 14. And the wall of the city had 12 foundations, and in them the names of the 12 apostles of the Lamb. So this is the 12 apostles. Remember in Matthew, we're going to read about these are 12 apostles, and there's 12 because they're going to sit on 12 thrones. And here we have, they're going to be anchored to 12 foundations, and they're going to have 12 gates. And each gate is a pearl. That had to be a pretty big pearl, a great pearl. And so I think that's what he's talking about in this pearl. Let's go back to Matthew 13. Matthew 13. And that's tied to the greatness that's going to come from that mustard seed. So during this time, the kingdom will be characterized by gradual seeking of good pearls. That's the whole point of these. They're going to be sowing the word of the kingdom. So unbelievers can be believers. Believers can become fruit bearers. Fruit bearers can produce more fruit. Going to be a time during which that happens. He's seeking his good pearls. And when the full complement of that believing remnant, when all his jewels are in place, it'll be like one big pearl, one great pearl. And that's what he's looking for here, verse 16, who when he had found one pearl of great price. What Jesus emphasized in this parable isn't even so much the treasure or the pearl in this case. He's emphasizing the greatness of it. So during this time, the kingdom will be characterized by gradual seeking of goodly pearls by Christ until he finds the great pearl, the believing remnant, so that he will. And then we come into this final phrase that really came up at the end of the last parable. But because we didn't have time for it last week, I figured we'd just go and finish up the pearl one, and now we can talk about this phrase, which is this idea of, let's go back here, this idea of the having to do with his selling. Look at the end of verse 44, Matthew 13, verse 44. You look at how the parable of the treasure ends. He selleth all that he hath and buyeth that field. And then look at the end of the pearl parable. It says he went and sold all that he had and bought it forth. And most commentators come along and they say this is the death of Christ. He gave up everything on that cross so that he could preserve his treasure and his pearl. Buy back his treasure and his pearl, redeem his people. And that's a very good way of looking at it. There's certainly aspects of that would be true. But I don't think that's the main thing he's talking about here, because this looks like something that he's going to be doing during that tribulation period. Not back in the past, an accomplished act in the past, but something he's going to be doing in that tribulation period. So I would suggest this is something different than his death on the cross. And I would suggest that what he's talking about here, just like in what we heard from the believing remnant in Malachi and the believing remnant and the Israelites within Egypt, he's going to leave them there for a length of time. And out in as a matter of fact, there's some places in the Bible that even talk about Israel. Remember, they were in Egypt for over 400 years, and many of them had forgotten everything God said. They thought God had forgotten them, and they'd forgotten God. And then, at the time at the appropriate time, according to his promise to Abraham, he returned and delivered them. Well, that's this time during the first and second coming of Christ, especially in that tribulation period. He's going to let Satan, he's going to hide his people in the earth system, and the world system. He's going to hide them there. And he's going to let Satan and his policy of evil go to work to take away as much as it can, to do its worst, to go to do whatever it can do to reach its highmost point of evil. And then he's going to come back and destroy them. He's going to call out his people, and it's going to cause the satanic system to topple. And let's just see what we're talking about here. Remember, after the resurrection, we haven't gotten there yet, but I think we all know this intuitively, if not by a specific verse. But go back to Matthew 28, verse 18. This is after the resurrection. Look what Jesus tells his disciples here. Matthew 28, verse 18. And Jesus came and spoke unto them, saying, all power is given unto me in heaven and earth. The whole heaven and the earth belong to Christ. He owns it. And of course, here, Matthew's especially interested in his ownership of the earth. Paul's going to carry it further and talk about his ownership of the heavenlies, the powers and principalities in heavenly places. Here, it's especially with regard to the earth, but it also includes the heavens. He has all power belongs to him. Everything belongs to Christ. But now let's look what he does during this period. He's going to hand them over. They're going to be hidden in this world system where Satan is going to be allowed to go as far as he can. He's going to be allowed to try and take away as much as he can. He's the usurper. He's not there because he's the owner of these things. He's usurped God and Christ and is now has long ago claimed the Gentiles for his own. When Israel went under the fifth course of punishment, he could claim Israel as his own. The whole world was his own. The whole world system. He's going to let that play out to the very end. And then he's going to come and reclaim what he has. Let's just go to Psalm 2 to see this a little more specifically. We'll only be here for a second, so keep a finger in Matthew. But in Psalm 2, he's talking about working through a little bit of the history of Israel here. And let's just pick it up at verse 6. Matthew 2, verse 6. Yet have I set my king upon my holy hill in Zion. I will declare the decree. The Lord hath said unto me, thou art my son, this day I have begotten you. But now look at verse 8. Everything belongs to the Son. Everything is his. He's the creator. He's the owner. He's the ruler. Everything belongs to him. But he's not going to exercise that authority right away, especially out in this tribulation period. He's going to let the usurper continue as far as he can, as wickedly as he can, to try and gain as much as he can. And then one day verse 9 is going to be spoken. Psalm 2 verse 9. Psalm 2 verse 8. Ask of me, and I shall give thee the heathen, the Gentile nations that belong to Satan. Now, he'll give them the Gentiles for his inheritance and the uttermost parts of the earth for his possession. Then he's going to come and reclaim his possession. He's going to establish his rulership and authority. He's going to buy back everything that belongs to him. And he's going to do it by delivering these people that grew into the great kingdom people and a great nation right under the noses, just like in Egypt, right under the noses of the Gentiles and of the vain religious system, and right under the nose of Satan, and they've grown into this great thing. And when he returns, he's going to, after Satan has done his worst, usurped as much as he can usurp, he's going to come and deliver out his people. and usher them into the land of the kingdom. And that's going to bring about the fall of the satanic world system, just like it caused the fall of Egypt, the kingdom of Egypt. All right, so that's where we are going to go now as far as the parable of selling all that he has. Then at his return, he'll take it back what is his, the whole world, beginning with the regathering of the nation of Israel and the land of the kingdom. All right, back to Matthew 12. Matthew 12, bound and determined to get through these. All right, so the next parable. So that leads into our next parable. Well, one other thing we should probably consider about the parable of the pearl is the merchant man. And here I'll just bring out one interesting observation. Do you know what the merchant man is a translation for in the Old Testament? It's a translation for the word Canaan. The promised land is called the land of Canaan. And the land of Canaan translated is the land of the merchant man. So I'd suggest that that's tying in. He's going to take his kingdom people that grow into a great nation. And during this tribulation period, during this time, right under the noses of the adversary, and he's going to take them out and bring them into the land of Canaan, the promised land, the land of the kingdom, which translates into the land of the merchant man. All right, so let's go to the next parable. Next parable, and then we're going to wrap this up and finish up our little overview of the parable here. And this is the parable of the dragnet. All right, back to Matthew 13. Matthew 13, verse 47. Matthew 13, verse 47. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a net that was cast into the sea and gathered of every kind. That's what this time period is going to be characterized. It's going to be the net's just going to be thrown out and it's going to draw in everybody. And then what happens? Verse 48, which when it's full, they drew it to shore and sat down and gathered the good into vessels, but cast the bad away. So here we have the same thing in the wheat and the tares, similar thing in the wheat and the tares. The wheat and the tares are going to be separated. And here we have the good and bad fish are going to be separated. Verse 49, so shall it be at the end of the world. And again, that's unfortunate. People read in there that it's talking about the end of the earth or the destruction of the earth or something like that. This is the end of the earth. This is the eon concept. This is the end of the ages. This is going to be the end of the age of the end of the age that refers to the end of that tribulation period, the fulfillment of Israel's prophetic time schedule, which will end with that final 7-year tribulation period. Verse 49, so the angels shall come forth and sever the wicked from among the just and shall cast them into the furnace of fire. There shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth, just like we read about in the wheat and the tares. All right, so that then, if we tie together our structure here, we see that that would correlate. That's the sister parable to the wheat and the tares, where it refers to what's going to happen at the end of that time. And that brings in the dragnet. The good and bad fish are going to be separated, the righteous and the unrighteous, the just and the wicked, and they're going to be separated at that time, just like the wheat and the tares in that second parable. All right, let's finish it off now. Let's look at the final parable here, and that's the parable of the scribe and the householder. All right, remember now, when we read this, I hope everyone realizes this isn't introduced the same way as all the other ones. Not all the other ones. This is uniquely introduced, like the first parable was uniquely introduced. The six parables between the first and last parable were all introduced with the kingdom is likened unto something. Well, look how this one opens. First, let's take note of verse 51 and see why we're going to classify this now in association to the sister parable to the first one. Because look what he asks them in verse 51. Jesus saith unto them, have you understood these things? Have you understood all these things? he's been instructing them, and he asks them if they understand. And look what they say. They say unto him, "Yes, Lord." So here we have, we're brought back to where we began in that parable of the sower, the idea of instruction and understanding, and he's bringing it right back to this point now as he closes this perfect package of these parables. He closes it now and he returns to this instruction and understanding concept. And now they say, "Yes, we understand." So now he makes them the scribes of the kingdom. Verse 52. "Then said he unto them, Therefore every scribe which is instructed unto the kingdom of heaven is like unto a man." Notice that's different. Though it's not the kingdom is likened, it's the scribe is likened. It's a different setup. It's not what one of the kingdom parables in the sense the one introduced by the kingdom is likened. This is a separate one like the first one. It's a more general one. It's a teaching one. Verse 52, instructed in unto the kingdom. It's still about the kingdom. I'm not denying that, but I'm saying it's not set up like the other six, but it's different like the first one was. And it's instructed unto the kingdom of heaven is like a man that is a householder, a stewardship, an apostleship, which a dispensation, which bringeth forth out of his treasure things new and old. And that's going to be the job, and we see it happening in early Acts. Peter and the 12 are going to start being the scribe of all the things Jesus taught in these parables. And the main thing they're going to be scribing and adding to the information the prophets had already had, that this is going to be set up as another great exodus. This is going to be another exodus, a greater exodus, a final exodus. The bulk of the time that's going to characterize this time period happens right here in the middle. In the hiddenness, he's going to hide them in the earth. And just like he hid them in Egypt, they grew into a great people right under the nose of the Egyptians, and they didn't even realize it. This, he's going to hide his people, the children of the kingdom in the earth, the Egypt of the earth, I guess we could say, to bring the motif through. And he's going to hide, they're going to grow into a great people. That leads to this mustard seed and the great pearl that's going to continue until the very end when Christ returns, when he's going to, with his angels, separate the wicked, the just from the unjust, the believers from unbelievers. And that's going to be encapsulated in a ministry that's bringing instruction and understanding. And that's what I suggest these parables are about. If you want to look at it a little different way, just in closing, I put this down another diagram. This might be hard for some to read, but I just thought I'd put it in a little different way, another way to organize this. The bottom here is really the key. It's that hiddenness concept, the leaven and the treasure going together. And the key verse there is going back to Matthew 10:26. And then you have the growing into greatness, the greatness of the mustard seed and the pearl. And then you have that being extended out all the way to the end when the revelation and judgment will come. And it's all going to be encapsulated as a time of instruction and instruction and understanding. That's going to be the ministry of this believing remnant during this time.